This podcast is proudly supported by Drama Victoria. Become a Drama Victoria member today to take advantage of the many member benefits. This podcast was recorded on the land of the Bunurong people. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Hello and welcome to The Aside, a podcast for drama teachers and students. I'm Nick Waxman and today we are speaking with Karen Johnson Mortimer. She is a distinguished director and choreographer. She began her career at 15 in Anything Goes. She is the associate director of the Australian tour of Wicked and has also held the role for Dirty Dancing, Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Wizard of Oz, Saturday Night Fever, Pippin, Chicago the Musical and the 60th anniversary production of My Fair Lady with Dame Julie Andrews. She's also Grease the Arena Spectacular. Karen's choreographic achievements include the Sydney 2000 Olympics. A former performer, she's appeared in a chorus line and was a regular on the Don Lane Show. We are talking with Karen Johnson Mortimer about her role as the Associate Director of Wicked. We're going to be breaking this interview into two chunks. We've got the Unit 3 Theatre Studies questions and the Unit 4 Theatre Studies questions. This episode is focusing on Unit 4 Theatre Studies, so the questions are targeted towards Unit 4, but I do strongly encourage you to listen to both the Unit 3 questions and the Unit 4 questions, because Karen Johnson Mortimer has been with this show for such a long time. She's able to deliver fabulous answers to these questions and has really interesting insight into the world of Wicked. I would listen to it just for pleasure, but if you're studying the subject and studying Wicked for your theatre studies, then absolutely listen to both, because really, these episodes are rich with detail about this fabulous production. Without any further ado, I bring you Karen Johnson Mortimer. Without any further ado, I bring you Karen Johnson Mortimer.
Hi there. Good morning. How are
Hello. Hello. I'm fabulous. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm in the theatre at the moment. We're about to have our first little audience. We've been in a week of rehearsals and technical rehearsals and, layer upon layer. And today's layer is now bringing in some real live people to hear some reaction from them.
That's amazing. So we're going to jump into questions about Unit 4 Theatre Studies. Could you please describe the status, motivation and characteristics of one of the significant characters in this production?
Let's talk about Elphaba. The status her character starts with is almost subservient. She's. I don't say she's comfortable with where everything lies in her life, but I think she just accepts it. And because she is so different in so many ways, particularly her physical appearance, she's not, yes, she accepts where she is, and her status is someone that will do as she's told. I think that's, she's smart, very smart, but she's smart enough to know don't rock the boat in the end, because it's only going to give you grief. I think perhaps that the motivation of her character, I think, is the uncorking or unleashing of her true self as we go through the show. I think that the thing that happens to her, it was like a pipe dream, always hearing about the Wizard of Oz and hearing about someone like him could make your dreams come true, is like every child, really, isn't it? Oh, if that could only happen to me. Oh, if I could only win the lottery. Oh, if, those sort of things. I think they're underneath. And as she gets to university, that dream becomes a little bit more tangible. And so when she's invited to meet the wizard, I think her motivation then becomes, no, don't settle for what you've got. Strive for more. It's a possibility. I've been accepted. And then finally, as I always say about Elphaba, morally, she is so grounded and so strong in her beliefs. When that temptation comes that she's going to have everything she ever wanted, but at a price, I think her motivation then flips, and the motivation then becomes, I'm better than that. She's an activist. I'm going to go out and be true to myself.
Excellent. Thank you. How would you say, or maybe one or two of the actors have used their acting skills? And for us, that's facial expression, voice, gesture, movement, and stillness and silence to interpret their characters.
Elphaba. Let's stay with Elphaba for a while. She she's physically awkward. That comes, you know, and that's just because that's who she is. So the acting, the skills that we have for her are that, so that we can absolutely see the difference between Glinda and Elphaba. Glinda is perfectly packaged, you know, the blonde, the accessories, the stance, the, you know, the eluding of friendship and come and be in my gang. It's confident, it's out there. Elphaba is strong, but don't rock the boat. Awkward. I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna buy into all of that sort of thing. So the acting, the expression, the gesture, and the movement, they're the juxtapositions between the two of them. So that's where Elphaba lies. Facial expression, very interesting when you're wearing green makeup, and that's why it's really important that the makeup is so good, because it has to come through. We have to see her pain, see her joy, have to see all of those sort of things. So we have to make sure that that reads for us as an audience, but we also have to make sure that it doesn't tip the bucket in becoming pantomime, because when you're wearing, you know, such makeup like that, it's a hard ask. But that's where the actor skills come into it. Our Elphaba Sheridan is an extraordinary young performer, and she showed us that in her audition. So it hasn't been too hard to work with her voice, her gesture, her movement. I mean, we direct her, of course, with stillness and silence and all of those sort of things, but she organically has a sense of all of those within her.
Wonderful. And I know the resource pack we're putting out, she's answered a few questions for us as well about how she's interpreted the character and used her facial expression. So that might be good to read from her perspective as well.
Right.
Can you think of a moment where the actors manipulate their focus to enhance the intended meaning of the work? Is there a moment where everyone, you know, looks up at a moment, or down at a page, or out to the audience? Or is there a moment where their focus shifts?
Yes, I think top of the show, perfect example when Glinda arrives. I mean, they're a bloodthirsty mob at the beginning, you know. She's dead, you know, it's finally, oh my God, we're released. And they're not joyous. Well, they're joyous, but they're sort of scary joyous, like they're just a mob that's been let loose. And so they're with one another, they're facing the audience, they're, you know, they're creating this energy around them. And then all of a sudden they hear Glinda's voice as she arrives in the bubble, and we, the focus and everything immediately swoops up to her, like two lights swooping up to her, and the focus comes straight over to there. That's a perfect example of that, I think.
Absolutely, and so iconic as well.
Yes.
How do the actors utilize the performance space in this work?
Clearly, on a technical point, it comes down to the blocking. There's a lot of, you need to be over on number four stage right. So as you know, a moving piece behind you doesn't collect you. So that, you know, that sort of template, or I like to call it the geography of the show, is taught to them. Secondary, like when we first do, we play with how they feel about a given moment or whatever, and then you have to hone it in and say, well, that's great, try and keep that integrity of what you were delivering, but now you need to create it into this space because this is where the lighting spot is, and we're setting for something else on that side of the stage. So that's how they use it when we try to blend, we try to mesh their absolute interpretation of their feeling and what they're saying, without stifling them too much by perhaps putting them and saying, don't move a half a number.
Yeah, and you also spoke in our last episode really beautifully about Madame Morrible and the smallness of the attic before defying gravity, and how that expands to use the space. And when they're hunting Elphaba as well, the mob versus Bock versus Glinda and Morrible on the side of the stage, like the space is just used in really inventive, creative ways throughout the work, including the levels high, flying up above
Absolutely.
us. The space is used, you know, in really exciting and engaging ways, I think.
The show in this theatre in the region in Melbourne looks absolutely amazing and even more expansive because of the actual size of the theatre and the way that it is. Like, I believe it used to be a cinema, like a lot of I could be wrong, but I believe it might have used to have been a cinema. So the sides of our proscenium extend out, and so there's more dressing of the show, there's more of the world. There's a giant beam over that crosses over the bottom of the stalls. There's more vines, there's more of the world. It's like almost like a picture book that's been unfolded two more times. So it's the space looks even bigger, the world looks even bigger. Yet we don't, on stage, it's exactly the same as whatever theater we put it in, but it's a different illusion down here, I think.
That's glorious. What a fabulous description of that. Can't wait to see it. So there, we have the language of the script. How is it used in your mind to convey the playwright's or director's intended meaning? Is language ever used, do you think, intentionally to communicate theme or message or character or anything?
I think, well, broadly, if you read through the script, there's fabulous that Winnie Holzman, who wrote the script, started playing on words with, and it started apparently just once or twice, as she and Stephen Schwartz were having meetings, and she would throw some lyrics or lines up, and instead of saying, well, that's thrilling, she started saying, putting in things like thrillify, and it sort of became a fun little joke. And in the end, it actually became an element, because all through the show, there's in the script, there's things like, oh, that's thrillify news, congratulations, excuse us, just a TikTok. There's all of that fabulous. It's not play on words. It's manipulating clever language, I think. But I think that absolutely is yet another fabulous way that the script and the text and everything that enhances the world that we are in. It's like their accent, it's like that's the Oz accent. This is how we say words.
Yeah, absolutely. They're a fabulous example of world building and creating this fantastical place
Yes.
just through choice of language. So could you talk us through some examples of elements of theatre composition in the piece? Awesome. So let's start with motion, the movement or implied movement of actors or design features in the theatre space. It could include position, pattern, arrangement, proportion, spatial flow. Can you think of an example of motion in the work?
Absolutely. I think choreographically, this show was informed and influenced by obviously the designs. So if you look at most of the ensembles, costumes and everything, they're sort of always off-kilter, not quite straight angles, hems, hats, tilted, all of that. The choreography and the motion of the choreography reflects that as well. It's classical, but if you look at it a little closer, it sort of is, but with an odd twist. And they, the lines in the movement in the choreography really embellish the oddness of Oz. I think that's probably a good way of explaining motion. I think that's mainly with the choreography. The staging so much is pretty straight clear. I think the ensemble with their tracks in the show enhance the motion of the show.
Absolutely. And you've already talked about the flow and how the pieces come in and come out and how it's like the wizard's card has exploded. And I think that was a really fantastic example as well with the monkeys and the curtain. That was really great. The flying monkeys, sorry. Why don't we talk about cohesion, which is just evident throughout this entire work. I don't know how you'll pick just one, but cohesion, the unity of balance of various aspects of the interpretation. Can you think of an example of cohesion in the work where maybe lighting, sound, set, acting all works together to create a clear vision?
I think the best example of cohesion is Elphaba Flynn. I think when they race, they come from the scene. She escapes from the wizard's chamber. She races out of that elaborate big Oz head and all that sort of beauty and awe, and races as she's escaping, and the guards are chasing her, and then they end up into the tiny attic. And it looks the way that the stage, that the lighting affects it. It looks like it is a tiny attic, and there's nowhere out two sort of like little shelves sitting there. And then we hear, that's very dark. And you're scared because you think there's no way out for her. And then all of a sudden, I this is my, when Morrible's up on the balcony and then starts with that Citizens of Oz and starts the propaganda about we have to find her and capture and kill her. The lighting is just on her head. I call it floating heads. I don't know if anybody's been to Disneyland, but if they've ever been to the ghost house there, that I remember years ago when I took my kids, how frightened I was of just disembodied heads, you know. And I think that that's the next thing that we see. We throw back down to Elphaba, and she is just in a special with Glinda. That's, it's dark, it's scary. And then she picks up her strength and decision not to be, to stay true to her morals. She's going to do that. She'll escape, but she's not going to be, she's not going to be bought. And as she grows and starts to find a strength and move around the stage, she opens up the stage a little bit, and she's moving side to side. So you get a sense of freedom, as if she's not cornered by these two sort of shelves around her. And then she magically brings the broom. She doesn't know what she's spell she's creating, but the broom arrives. It flies in. Things are starting to open up, gently open up, but still very dark. Then the broom comes down and the two of them to make the decision. And Glinda steps back. Elphaba, they basically say, get out of here now. They're going to break down that door. Get out of here. She races upstairs into, and you think she's gone. It's just black. Everything's black. And then the guards race in and they're just sort of pushing it. Glinda back and forward and back and forward, and then finally you hear Elphaba's voice and a special hits her, and you just see her face coming forward and everything's starting to just become alive. And as she travels forward and then she flies up, the whole stage opens and it looks like one giant black cape flying with her above everybody. So it's, I think that the cohesion of the set, our automation, our lighting, our cast, our orchestration is probably the best version, the best example of cohesion I can give for this show.
And incredibly well described. Thank you. That was incredible listening to that. What a beautiful moment. Yeah, it's such a powerful example of how theatre can excite and challenge and delight us. It's brilliant. And then there are moments of, I mean, of course, you indicated rhythm in that answer as well. But can you think of an example of rhythm, the pace, timing, and tempo within the interpretation? Are there certain scenes that you think that rhythm is really important?
This whole show is cleverly written from text to song, and nothing in it. I don't ever feel, well, actually, I don't. I should never feel that we are just finished a scene and here's a song just to go with it. It's always seamlessly the dialogue blends into the, you know, the narrative is continued in the song and the lyric. Here's an example. So at the top of Act Two, when they sing Thank Goodness and they're talking about the Wicked Witch, and there's all Madame Morrible is delivering dialogue as well as song, but rhythmically everything has to happen on a beat, you know, an offbeat. You speak now, you speak then. So it's a lot of the show is like that, where the actual orchestration underneath you needs to be adhered to and keeping that rhythm. Here's another example of why you have to keep that rhythm. There's a scene in that actual scene where Glinda and Fiero walk downstage and have this sort of argument on downstage, right? There is the underscoring going on and there's a moment of confrontation and Fiero has to sort of think, what's he going to do? Is he going to stay or is he go? So it's a pause. Now, if he pauses too long, the oboe player can expire down in the pit because he's holding a note. And we have to say, you take your moment now, come in, otherwise. So that's, yeah, rhythm, very important for all that's concerned.
Important timing in that moment.
Yes.
Save the oboist.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I think we've just finished talking about defying gravity, but there are maybe other moments in the piece as well. Emphasis is one of the elements of theatre composition, aspects of the interpretation that are given particular focus, importance, or prominence. And I wonder if you can think of an example of emphasis from this work, this show full of brilliant emphasis.
All of them, but perhaps a very good example would be One Short Day, which is when Elphaba and Glinda finally arrive at the Emerald City, and the whole of the staging and the set and the lighting is such a nod to the Wizard of Oz, emphasizing, the wizard himself in three giant sort of. We call them flatheads, but jolly characters that race out and sort of dance, and everyone's around being so excited, singing about the wizard. So it's emphasis on that. Here you are. You're going to meet the wizard. Here's three of them, just to give you a little bit of excitement before you actually walk into the door. Elphaba's excitement about being there is emphasized by her being given green glasses, by people taking photos of her, by characters coming and dancing around her, enticing her to come up. It's all that whole number is about making her feel comfortable and excited about finally walking in and meeting the wizard in the Emerald City.
Yeah, brilliant example. Contrast is throughout this work. Look at the contrast between our two lead characters. Maybe the contrast between Nessa when we first meet her and then when we see her as governor of Munchkin Land. Contrast plays a big role in this piece. Can you think of an example of how contrast or the juxtaposition of seemingly different or opposing aspects or qualities within the interpretation?
Yeah, I think Nessa's a perfect example of that. I think she, I think when we first meet her, she's sweet, but she's spoiled. She's daddy's little girl, and Elphaba isn't. And Nessa just comes to expect, without being mean, comes to expect that Elphaba is there for her, to help her, to do everything for her. When so that's her, and also she's finally, with the help of Elphaba, being allowed to enjoy the fun of being at school and meeting new friends and having someone ask her out. So she's sweet, and we feel for her, but we're excited for her. Yes, twist it, Act Two, and things haven't turned out so well, and she's in a situation where she never wants to be. She finally had, she thought, the boy that she wanted to be with, but has discovered that he doesn't want anything to do with her. And her will and want, because the power that she has now as governor, cruelly keeps him there. She's trying not to have him as a servant, but she's so spoiled, she's so self-absorbed, that she now has the power to do anything she wants, and even if he doesn't want to be there, she's going to make him stay there, and she's somehow going to turn him around to be there happily. And when Elphaba comes in, she just there's no thanks for anything Elphaba's ever done for her. All she can think about is herself now, totally herself, being on her own, and just degrades her basically with the way that she speaks, and so I think that's the Nessa story, and Nessa's transformation from Act One to Act Two is a perfect contrast, I think, too. I mean, it subtly goes through, of course, because the journey of the two witches is the show, but the contrast from the beginning, when they first sing Loathing, to when they sing For Good, perfect contrast. She's now on the other foot for both of them, and it's a deep friendship.
Absolutely. It's such a beautiful, touching moment in the show, too. And our last element of theatre composition and the last question for Unit 3 is about variation, which is slightly different to contrast, because contrast is two things opposing each other or massive difference. And variation is those changes to the dynamics in the interpretation. Could be use of tension, conflict, intensity, energy, and use of space, how that is varied in the work. Can you think of an example in wicked, where we see variation occur?
Absolutely, and I think the Witch Hunters is probably the Witch Hunters scene in Act Two, I think, is a very good example of variation, because what we see is the mob that want to kill. They want to find her, and they want to get her, and they have all of the tools and the weaponry that, you know, that they charge to you, charge straight to the front to you, and it's just massive movement on stage and using the whole of the deck of the stage. And then all of a sudden we jump up to Bok, who is now the Tin Man, and it, as opposed to he's talking to them, but he's in a tiny, tiny spot. So it's almost like a vignette. All of a sudden, their wide expanse, but he's talking to them from a small room and explaining wasn't only him, but the lion cub that was affected by this dreadful, wicked, wicked witch. So he's talking to a giant crowd. Then, bang, we go over to the other side of the stage, and it's like Madame Morrible and Linda have been, you could say they're not listening to all what's going on a radio, if there was a radio. And it's so for them, it's visually what they're seeing, perhaps in their head, even though they're sort of veering, looking over the scene. It's like they're in another space. And she's saying, come on. It's as if she's in a room saying, listen, that mob out there, you know, they're doing all those things for all the wrong reasons, and we've got to stop it. We've just absolutely got to stop it. So I feel that that's a good example of the variation of the show, just because I feel like it's three scenes in three different sort of areas.
Yeah, brilliant example. Thank you so very much for sharing that. And there are so many throughout this amazing production of Wicked. So how do you feel that the actor-audience relationship is manipulated or established or maintained in this world? What relationship do the performers have with the audience? Does it shift or change in the work, or is it consistent throughout?
There's a saying that a lot of directors, and I use as well, or that you need to bring the audience along with you. Don't let them in too much, because it changes the atmosphere and the temperature of the show. You have to, as I said, the script and the story is as is. So audiences are going to react differently all the time. So if you give a nod or let that in, it can change what you're trying to do on stage and the message that you actually are supposed to be giving. You know, the audience are not another performer in the show. They are someone that are experiencing your storytelling. So that's from a performer's side, that where their responsibility is to keep true to the story. However, audiences also shape us as far as their reactions time-wise. You know, it helps. It's a skill. It's a skill for a lot of actors, particularly a lot of new actors, to actually be able to know exactly when to pick up and move on, or exactly when to just take a breath for a second. Otherwise, if we start talking now and they're still laughing or clapping, they're going to miss the next piece of information that they need to have. So that's a grand skill, particularly for actors and singers. And yeah, that's what we've got today. That's why we've got our family and friends, tiny little first new audience, so we can sense and hear the timing of reactions. It's another part, it's another layer of the show.
Yeah, so generally you would say that this is probably a fourth wall show. They don't break the fourth wall and engage with the audience at any point. Maybe a few moments, Glinda may do a few exactly. Sneaky looks. That's about all, probably.
Not a lot. There, you're right. Probably one or two, but no. Otherwise, if you break that fourth wall like that, it's different style. It's pantomime. This is not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we break into it and kind of zoom over the audience in a few moments, but that's still maintaining the world. You don't break the world.
Yeah, we do look at it at the audience a lot, but we consider them an extension of the people that are on stage. Our world is beyond. Our world is beyond their our world as well. So that's why we take it in. So it doesn't look like you're playing to the audience. It's like you're part of us. You know, you are probably another one of these students in Shiz over here. So. Yeah.
Great. Subtle endowing the audience. That's really cool. Our final question, thank you so very much for giving us so much of your time. Listening to you talk about this production as someone that's been involved with it for such a long time is really inspiring and exciting. So thank you for talking with us today. How do the actors, in your mind, demonstrate the style of this production? So there are lots of different theatrical styles that the theatre studies, study design gives us. But I wonder if there are a few clear examples in your mind. Things that jump to my mind are musical theatre, magic realism, moments of romance and comedy and tragedy drama. But there may be specific ones you'd like to talk about.
I think you just said them all, didn't
I didn't mean to, sorry. But yes, are there any one of those? I mean, musical theatre, it's a musical theatre piece, absolutely.
let's talk about that for me, because that's probably that's where my heart is, and it has been for so much. It's musical theatre, but musical theatre in 2024 is different from musical theatre when I first started, say in 1971, 1972, in huge productions like this, where everything was far more presentational. It was highlighted, it was to reach an audience. But there was, as we discussed before, there was a lot of winking and nodding to the audience that was allowed, not necessarily directed, but allowed. I think musical theatre, and particularly with Wicked, it's morphed in 20 years, but morphed as far as perhaps, I think, with things such as social media and just those reality programs and everything, everyone's attention span wants something immediate, wants something. So I think that we haven't taken anything out of the show, but I think the pace of our show is probably a little faster, because, as I said, people are, want to hear it now, want to hear it now. But you can't hear it so fast that you don't hear the story. And then I think we're a mix, the musical theatre style that we present, a mix of naturalism but overarching musical theatre. So it's not, the movements are certainly heightened, but they're not real. They're not caricature. That's stylistically, that's what we aim for. We don't, we absolutely, absolutely honor the genre that we're in, but we also don't want to make it too caricature, basically.
Yeah, there are some great examples of in the work, as you spoke about before, about scene into song and about how the dialogue seamlessly transitions into song, in Madame Morrible's song, as well as obviously Elphaba's No Good Deed. There are probably great examples of how text into song can work really powerfully. Can you think of a moment where maybe the choreography tells a story, which is a big part of musical theatre?
Definitely. Elphaba's dance when she hits Ozdust. She's been talking about her awkwardness, her discomfort in well-packaged people. And she mistakenly thinks Glinda was being very lovely to her by giving her this glorious black hat, and wears it to there, and then makes morally stands up for herself again. Is she going to run out crying? No, she's not. You embarrassed me. I'm going to stand here. You invited me to the dance. I'm going to stand here. So she starts doing her dance, which is so awkward and uncomfortable to look at, and all of those sort of things. And everybody's laughing. And then finally, Glinda, so guilt, riddled with guilt, decides she needs to make this right, make this good. So she goes over and she takes the movements that Elphaba is trying to do, and she makes them pretty. She softens them, but she basically what says, dance with me. This is a great dance, but try it this way. And then slowly and surely the ensemble start to also do the Elphaba dance, but the new version. So choreographically, that's a great twist in the show.
Brilliant and fabulous example. Thank you hugely for giving us your time today. You've answered so many questions and given us over an hour for both units of study, so we couldn't be more thankful. Thank you very much for your time, Karen Johnson Mortimer.
Thank you very much. All the best.
That's all for this episode of The Aside. Thank you hugely to Karen Johnson-Mortimer for giving us her time. She spent over an hour with us answering questions, as well as the questions she's given for the resource pack, which is connected to Wicked as well, which you can access from the Wicked website, which I will link in the episode description. That may be all for this episode, but we have two episodes of The Aside on Wicked, the Unit 3 episode and the Unit 4 episode, and I encourage you to please listen to both. We also have a load of episodes in the bank, over 400 episodes now, on all kinds of different subjects related to the Victorian curriculum, theatre studies and drama, so feel free to go through those and find one that piques your interest. If you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, or you would like to ask us a question, feel free to email us at asidepodcast@outlook.com, or you can find us on Facebook. We answer a number of questions each week, and we are more than happy to help. Thank you to Aaron Searle for providing the music, to Halebury for letting us record here, to Drama Victoria for their ongoing support, and of course, thank you for listening.